So this morning is the last week in the series that we've called Deep Roots this fall. This is a season that worship committee and pastoral staff thought a lot about months and months ahead of this fall, about how we would shape our gathered time here together this fall as another monumentally consequential election looms. We tried to imagine what we might be feeling as November was nearing. How would we be faring in body, mind, and soul, as individuals, as families, as a congregation, as a local community, as a nation? It was easy to visualize sort of a growing storm, and that was without any of us remembering ahead of time that it would also be hurricane season, which we have certainly seen this fall. But Deep Roots was meant to be kind of an anchoring image. What are the deep knowings, the deep hopes, the teachings and practices that have stood the test of time that can keep us grounded securely enough that we can be supple enough above ground to weather difficult times? People who continue to practice an organized religion, especially people who aren't currently in a crisis or who have enough resources to materially survive without a faith community, I sometimes wonder if we are perceived as spiritual preppers. We believe in maintaining the practices and stockpiles of resources that we know we'll need at some point, even if we can't see the ways in which we actually do need them and benefit from them now. To many people on the outside looking in, I think it looks like foolishness. And to increasing numbers of people still practicing religion, I think they wonder if it's a bit foolish. So the deep root I'd like to look at this morning, the Anabaptist tradition's stubborn capacity to withstand accusations of foolishness. I also want to be clear right from the start that our congregation, even just looking at our congregation, has benefited tremendously from the many ways we've been shaped by the many, many CMCLers who aren't Anabaptist or Mennonite by background. And we're lucky that here that's about half of us, I think. My guess is that part of what makes CMCL a good fit for people who are and aren't Mennonite by background is that many of us who are drawn here share contrarian streaks, I would guess. Mennonites have often emphasized Romans 12, do not be conformed to the world, but transformed by the renewing of the mind. The teachings on this are often shortened simply to nonconformity, as Jane excellently led our kids in sort of a primer on this morning. I find it interesting that we didn't come up with the parallel shorthand of pro-transformity, but we did come up with nonconformity, which the verse would imply, I think, both are equally important. But I read an interesting blog recently, and I'll link to it when I send the sermon out if you're interested, written by someone who is, from what I gather, a more conservative Mennonite than me in the plain sense, not necessarily, maybe also theologically, but in the plain sense, at least at some point, this person was. And it was really interesting to read this person's questions and also sort of some history about Mennonites and nonconformity. He quotes a book by Melvin Gingrich that I thought might be of interest to you, Amelia, Mennonite Attire Through Four Centuries. So anyhow, I'm sure it's not nearly as interesting as the Parisian fashion you've looked into. But I found it interesting. I've heard this, and it's not the first time I'd heard it, but he laid it out in some interesting ways about how Mennonites actually didn't practice the kind of nonconformity that we think of as plain dress until the mid-1860s here in North America. That means that for the first 350 out of 500 years of Mennonite history, we didn't dress that different. I remember seeing an old black and white photo of some of my Mennonite ancestors pre-migration to the U.S. in the 1800s and being absolutely stunned that they looked very stylish. The women were like lined up. They looked, you know, sort of corsets and puffy skirts. And the men were lined up in a row behind them, like with cigars, like everybody looking at the camera. It's like, whoa. Yeah, that wasn't really emphasized to me growing up somehow. But I'm not talking about you, Mom and Dad. I'm talking about generations further back, let's say. But it's interesting for me to note that, given that I think in America anyway, if people who aren't from Lancaster, like I've spent enough time in non-Lancaster areas to know that most people, if they know anything about Mennonite, if they know enough to know that we're not Mormons, you know, anything with a capital M will do, then they think of plain dress. But it's interesting to note that that hasn't always been from our tradition. Although, for the Amish, it is a much longer standing tradition. back from the late 1600s, the Amish were practicing that. And since genetically many, many Mennonites are sort of Amish from down the slippery slope, as some would say, we definitely probably have some ancestors who were doing more plain dressing. So this blog introduced me to a writer who was a bishop in northern Germany in the 1600s into the 1700s. His name is Gerhard Rosen. Not sure if I'm saying that correctly in German, but he is, quote, famous today, mostly for the catechism he published when he was 90 years old. So this would have been in like the early 1700s, called Christliches Gemütsgespräch, or this is actually the title. It's not a new paragraph, I promise. Christian spiritual conversation on saving faith and the acknowledging of the truth, which is after godliness in hope of eternal life, Titus 1:1-2, in questions and answers for the rising youth, by which they may be incited and encouraged to a wholesome practice of life. Yeah, I don't think publishers these days would let you get away with that one, but the common English title is simply Rosen's Catechism, and up to 1970, it was still being used among the Amish. But ironically, Rosen was apparently a man of deep piety but moderate views. When he was 85, he wrote a letter to his Alsatian brethren protesting against the strict rules on clothing that had been made by Jacob Ammann, who started the Amish. So I'm going to read you some of this letter, just because I think it's fascinating to be privy to this conversation about dress like 300 years ago. I am sincerely grieved that you have been so disturbed by those who think highly of themselves and make laws of things which are not upheld in the gospel. Had it been specified in the apostolic letters how or wherewith a believer should be clothed, then these had something of which to speak. But it is more contrary to the gospel to affix one's conscience to a pattern of the hats, clothes, stockings, shoes, or the hair of the head, and then for one to undertake the enforcement of such regulations by punishing with the ban all who will not accept them, and to expel from the church as a leaven those who do not wish to avoid those thus punished. Though neither the Lord Jesus Christ in his gospel or his holy apostles have bound us to external things, nor have deemed it expedient to provide such regulations and laws. Wherefore then does our friend Jacob Ammann undertake to make laws of such things for the people and to expel from the church those who will not obey him? If he considers himself a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ and advocates a literal administration of the law, then he must not wear two coats, nor carry money in his purse or shoes on his feet. Thanks be to God, I do not want showy array or worldly lusts, and have always continued wearing nearly the same pattern of clothes. But if I had dressed in modern fashion, should I then for this reason be excommunicated? This would be an injustice and contrary to the scriptures. It is a dangerous venture to step into the judgment of God and bind that which is not bound in heaven. So I just thought it was a fascinating argument from the early 1700s from an 85-year-old bishop. So, yeah. So yes, perhaps I read a little bit more of that than I needed to, but I just thought it was such an interesting conversation. 325 years ago, Mennonites were talking about our dress. But on the one hand, I'm actually very grateful for a tradition that has practiced nonconformity in dress. I remember as a teenager feeling the pressures to look and dress cool. Yes, I was a kid in the 80s, so cool was just the word. Even though I didn't grow up dressing plain or that different, there was a certain comfort and courage in knowing my people had stood up to persecution, even persecution due to aggressively bad fashion. That was my estimation, which was more relatable as a teenager than persecution over baptismal practices. When I lived in Atlanta and would talk to folks who only knew of Mennonites from popular media portrayals of the Amish or plain Mennonites, they would ask, how can you be in the same faith as them? Because I didn't look like they thought a Mennonite should look. And I would say, well, I think we actually have very similar beliefs, but we interpret them very, very differently. For me, nonconformity looks, for example, and this was, I'm quoting myself from 15, 20 years ago, when this would have been more nonconforming, thankfully. But for me, nonconformity looks like being a welcoming faith community, whereas conservative Mennonites would say that being welcoming is conforming to the world. For me, that's weaponizing naivete, given the threats to the LGBTQ survival and thriving in this country. But those would be very different ways of saying we both believe in nonconformity and interpreting it very, very differently. It seems to me that many of Jesus' teachings were nonconformist. The law was constantly being quoted to him, and so often he would respond in such a way that he was accused of being nonconformist about the law. But I think he was often simply showing that you have to be willing to constantly interrogate and interpret the law and never be blindly conformist to a current, even popular, interpretation of the law. He was constantly holding up current interpretation of law against deeper values of compassion, hospitality, and justice. Some of his ideas are, frankly, almost absurd, and I think he knew that. If you're asked to walk a mile, go an extra mile. Asked to give up your coat, give up your shirt as well. Smacked around, offer the other cheek. Now, there's a lot of good speculation and research about what these could have meant in not absurdist ways. For example, it's possible that by turning your other cheek, it would mean that the person slapping you would now be slapping you as their equal instead of slapping the side of the cheek that would indicate that they were a person more powerful than you, for example. So it's possible that all of these made an obvious sense to listeners or readers at the time. But I still think that I feel like there's an element of throwing out examples that would have not necessarily been obvious. And perhaps for the very purpose of helping us see ways in which we're not even aware that we're conforming. He was also clearly just as concerned about how we do conform to our own communities of faith in ways that sometimes should be interrogated more, just as much as how we conform to the world outside us. And I think this was something that we often saw insiders to the world would expect that the teachings would reinforce the ways that they were not like the world outside them. And I think we're taken aback often to realize that faith and religion involved critique of the internal community as well. The phrase in Romans 12:2 that we read this morning is, "Be transformed by the renewing of the mind." And I'm struck by just grammatically, that sentence, that it's not be transformed, you will be transformed once you have renewed your mind, like it's done, past tense, you did that, now you're transformed. It's you will be transformed by the renewing of the mind, an ongoing thing. You're not just looking for a new conformity, I think we're being invited to a flexible and, yes, exhausting ongoing state of interpretation. It's not just laws that need to be renewed, but our minds need ongoing renewal. And somehow therein lies transformation. Excuse me. And here's where I think the Isaiah passage comes in. And another Mennonite deep root that kind of partners with nonconformity, which is this notion of a third way. Anabaptism emerged after, or at the tail end of, the Protestant Reformation. And Anabaptists and Mennonites have often understood ourselves to be, quote, neither Protestant nor Catholic, but instead a third and different way of practicing Christianity. Anabaptists felt that there were some ways in which Protestants didn't go far enough in their reforms of the Catholic tradition, and there were aspects of Catholicism rejected by reformers that Anabaptists did not want to reject. And Mennonites in the last century have seen this notion of a third way as, I think, very central to our faith, or at least I've seen many times where that phrase, a third way, has been adopted over the last the decades that I have been alive and paying attention in the Mennonite Church. That in so many situations, we have sought a different option than the ones most obviously available. When I first learned about philosopher Immanuel Kant's theory of knowledge, that we first develop a thesis and then counter it with an antithesis, and then a synthesis emerges which balances the two, I remember thinking, well, this is what we Mennonites have been talking about, right? But really, I think the idea is that this becomes a rolling organic thing, where you don't just reach a synthesis and forever for all time, that third thing is now the correct thing. But that synthesis now sort of de facto becomes its own new thesis, and therefore, it behooves us to interrogate it and come up with a new antithesis and then a synthesis again. And I think when you're in the midst of this, this can be really difficult. When you experience something and you were a part of a movement to see a new way to synthesize that, it can be really hard to welcome the new voices that then want to synthesize what you arrived at by blood, sweat, and tears. And I think history shows us how hard that is to be able to perceive a new thing happening as potentially good when you have been highly invested in the last thing, and you know that the thing before that, you know, had its limitations. So again, I think it's this rolling thing. But I love how this Isaiah passage has a vision of God as one who can see new ways. And I like this language of new ways, not necessarily third, because again, I think it implies this idea of not a final, but sort of always a new. A God who can imagine a road in the middle of a body of water, a path through a wild place where no feet have trodden, and that this God invites us to look and see, can we recognize it? Can we recognize and see when God is trying to make a path through a way that we haven't seen a way? Because we have a tradition that has boldly, wisely, foolishly sometimes, been willing to try new things, ways that others around us have been surprised by, and that hasn't stopped us. And I'm not saying everything we have tried has been great, but we've been willing to think up new ideas and try them even when they've been appeared foolish to others. At the beginning of this sermon, I made a point of mentioning that being nonconformist or contrarian or willing to look at things or engage third ways isn't something Mennonites can copyright or trademark. We are certainly not the only ones. But those traits can be found in our history, ancient and recent, in our institutions and academic contributions, in our protest movements, and even in our lovely, contrarian, nonconformist ways that each of us engage within our congregations and how our congregations engage our conferences and our denomination. It's sort of like the beauty and the frustration of our community, I think, is that we don't easily settle for, okay, this is what we're going to do, all of us, and follow it forever. There are always new things, and that's good. And our willingness to stand up to what we believe, for what we believe, is so good. I think it's a solid thing, even if, again, it can be frustrating. One of the reasons that I chose the image on our bulletin cover today is just because it evokes this idea of vision and seeing things in new ways, as 3D glasses do. And there would be lots of provocations with the colors of the lenses and, you know, all those things. And, you know, I don't even know, but I just thought it was just a really interesting way to think. One way to visualize a third way of seeing would be through a 3D lenses as well. But I also want to acknowledge that there are significant ways in which our tradition alone did not always open my eyes. But I hope at least gave me some groundwork to comprehend when a new way is being presented to me. I think about the ways that the genderqueer movement, which, because of Christian history, didn't emerge within Christianity, but outside of it, and we've been trying to catch up to it, the ways that that movement has blown apart the limits of a third way in profound ways, helping us all see that something we thought was a binary is far from it, and also helping us to see the sprawling way more than three ways that even one truth or one facet, gender, can be understood. And I wonder how many truths we've understood as binary that could be exploded and expanded in a similarly complex and beautiful way. So as we move even closer into the election time in our country and the many possibilities that lay beyond it, no matter who wins, may these deep roots of nonconformity and pro-transformity and 3++ ways from our tradition nourish us, give us strength, and inspire us and resource us come what may. That is my prayer for me and for us, that we may have the courage to step up, step in, remain present and engaged in faithful ways, even when the way isn't clear. And it's hard to imagine what the way will look like, what the reality will be that we will be finding a way through, even in just a few weeks. But our God is one who says, I can see a way where you don't see a way. So my prayer is that we can have the eyes to perceive that as it is being made forward for the surviving and the flourishing of everyone on earth as it is in heaven. May it be so. Amen.